Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, September 12, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss the Clean Power Plan case in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, with a particular focus on the constitutional issues. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We have two experts with us. Each is going to give us opening remarks of something less than 10 minutes. We'll hear them in order, hearing first from David B. Rivkin, Jr. He's a partner at Baker & Hostetler. He's going to, in addition to giving an outline of his argument, he's going to give us some background on the case initially, so to bring you up to speed in case you're not familiar with the case. Then we'll hear from David Bookbinder. He's the founding member at Element 6 Consulting. But as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions. So with that, Mr. Rivkin, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean, and it's a pleasure to be with you. Just to set the posture for the case briefly, we're talking about the Clean Power Plan. That, of course, is a major regulatory effort by EPA, to put it crisply, to fundamentally change the energy economy in this country. They refer to it in several places as generation shifting, but essentially we're talking about vitiating the existing installed coal-fired capacity, either having it completely retired or having it utilized a lot less than they would have been dispatched based upon the traditional least cost dispatch paradigm that that all state utility commissions basically compel. This is a very important aspect of the administration's anti-coal strategy, again, to put it somewhat straightforwardly, and procedurally this rule is or has been stayed by the Supreme Court. That is really quite unprecedented, that in that no rule of general applicability has really been stayed by the Supreme Court. The vote was 5-4. Obviously, Chief Justice Scalia was still alive at the time that vote took place. Another unusual procedural aspect, we were originally, I should say, when I say we, I should back up and say that I represent the states in this area, and will be participating, carrying the constitutional portion of the argument in the unbunk D.C. Circuit oral argument that's coming up on the 27th. Another thing I've frankly never seen in over years I've been practicing law is that the D.C. Circuit has converted the consideration of this case from a panel level consideration to en banc, and it's done so sua sponte, meaning that neither petitioners nor the government have sought that. So we'll be before the nine judges in the D.C. Circuit on the 27th. Well, let me briefly switch to the the merits, at least as we see it. We believe it, and by the way, the Clean Power Plan is utterly objectionable based upon normal statutory interpretation principles, the way in which the agency parses the relevant section of the Clean Air Act, but I'll spend the balance of my time, and David and I would be debating today, really, the constitutional issues and not statutory interpretation issues, and particularly the federalism issues, because there are also some horizontal separation of powers problems of what EPA has done. So we believe that the Clean Power Plan is utterly unconstitutional because it commandeers and coerces states to undertake actions that EPA lacks preemptive power to implement by itself. And since Congress, in that regard, hasn't given EPA authority to regulate the generation and distribution of electricity, the agency's effort to force states to do this is a profoundly unconstitutional exercise of EPA's preemptive authority. I would submit that it violates decades' worth of Supreme Court anti-commandeering and anti-coercion jurisprudence, including such seminal cases as Hodel versus Virginia Surface Mining and Reclamation Association, New York versus United States, Prince versus United States, Stewart Machine versus Davis of Dakota v. Dole, and of course, the NFIB versus Sibelius. So with the CPP, for the first time in 230 plus years of American constitutional history, where the federal agency that is seeking to commandeer and coerce states into regulating in the field where that agency lacks preemptive power to regulate itself. After some soul searching, we call this preemptive mismatch in our briefing. We have to come up with a name for it because it's so unprecedented. So let me walk you briefly through the existing case law and elaborate on our coercion and commandeering arguments. Under the teaching of Hodel, the federal government is free to carve out a role for states in the context of a federal regulatory program when it's exercising its power under the Supremacy Clause to take over the entire field and regulate solely from Washington, D.C. However, the court also emphasized in Hodel that, I quote, if a state does not wish to regulate consistent with the statute, the full regulatory burden would be borne by the federal government. Thus, there can be no suggestion that the act commandeers the legislative processes of the states by directly compelling them to enact and enforce a federal regulatory program. And indeed, it's axiomatic that the fidelity to, end of quote, I apologize. So back to my own words, indeed, it's axiomatic that fidelity of the Constitution's federalism architecture, meant to promote individual liberty by diffusing governmental power among two sets of coequal sovereigns, and fostering accountability to the American people by making clear to them which sovereign bears responsibility for any particular set of public policy, requires the Supreme Court reemphasize it in New York, but the federal government must, quote, offer states the choice of regulating an activity according to federal standards or having state law preempted by federal regulation, close quote. Here, unfortunately for EPA, unlike the situation with Hodel, given the full extent of a statutory authority that it received from Congress, EPA could never issue regulations taking over at the federal level, electricity generation and distribution. So in the CPP, the agency, unlike in Hodel, isn't allowing the states the regulatory role driven by federal blueprint in lieu of federal preemptive takeover. EPA instead is seeking to exercise regulatory power using states as its involuntary agent in an area, ladies and gentlemen, in which it has no power at all. Now, CPP doesn't even pretend to do otherwise. EPA not only lacks actual legal authority to regulate all aspects of regeneration and distribution of electricity, but it doesn't even claim to be able to do so, candidly acknowledging that all the required actions can be undertaken only by states. The CPP commandeers states and state officials in both legislative and executive branches of state government to carry out the federal policy for what EPA calls their, quote, responsibility to maintain a reliable electric system, close quote. Now, EPA touts the fact that the states have flexibility, even if assuming that that is the case. It is utterly constitutionally deficient because, as the court also stated in New York, it, quote, only underscores the crucial alternative a state lacks. A state may not decline to administer the federal program, close quote. That is the alternative that CPP denies to the states. There is nothing they can do, just nothing. But and the degree of commandeering involved, both in terms of state personnel and resources that they have to be engaged while they carry out various legislative and regulatory tasks, as they restructure their energy economies, as well as the significance of political accountability of a policy issues at stake here, vastly exceed anything that was at stake in New York and Prince. To briefly describe what is the degree of commandeering here, as well as coercion, let me say this. Once EPA prescribes for a federal plan the retirement of fossil fuel-fired plants or reductions in their utilization, state lawmakers, as well as state regulators, will have to respond with numerous legislative and regulatory actions relating both to the decommissioning of a now forbidden underutilized generating facilities, as well as the construction of new generating assets and associated distribution facilities so as to seamlessly integrate them into the electric grid. All aspects of the state energy economy would have to be altered. The fuel mix, the balance between generation and transmission, balance between baseload generation and peaking facilities, balance between close to low generation facilities and long distance generation facilities. And to stress, EPA isn't just providing some general guidance, which would be constitutionally problematic, but it is providing a very, very precise spec of how the new energy economy has to be built, both on a state-by-state basis and regional basis. And aside from a regulation of a physical construction and decommissioning and recommissioning of various generation distribution assets. States, of course, will continue to bear full responsibility for various rate-making decisions, exercising its traditional responsibility for balancing the needs of ratepayers, both long-term and short-term, the imperative of economic development. Now, EPA's only rejoinder to our anti-commandeering argument is that no commandeering will take place because the federal government does not directly compel states to enact and enforce a federal regulatory program a la New York, but rather if a federal plan is implemented, EPA will take care itself of all the air quality-related issues associated with the new generating facilities, and all what the state regulators would have to do is to process requests from private parties desirous of building new generation and distribution facilities. And they further submit that having states process requests from private parties, even if such requests are ultimately shaped by federal requirements, does not a commandeering make. Of course, that argument is, to put it gently, silly, because once EPA destroys states' existing energy economy, because all states have legal and political responsibility for reliability and affordability of electric energy, they would have no choice, ladies and gentlemen, but to participate extensively in the design of a new energy economy. In this respect, every single state has laws in the books that require numerous state regulatory entities to design the overall electricity generation and distribution networks in that state. To say that the states can choose to do nothing in this area by abandoning their traditional responsibility and instead would merely wait for multiple private parties to come forward and, in fact, would be the ultimate privatization of an area that's been the traditional area of state police power. Well, they put it somewhat strongly. It's absurd. Now, let me just close by saying that CPP's unprecedented commandeering is coupled with an equally unprecedented degree of coercion. In light of a Hobbesian level consequences of a state decision not to undertake the activities being compelled by the rules. Now, it's not just the pivotal importance of electricity for the 21st century civilization, where the impact of even modest declines in reliability and availability, affordability of electricity would have huge impacts on all spheres of private and public life, ranging from public safety, healthcare, transportation to food distribution, that frankly make the gun to the head Medicaid-related scenarios at issue in NFIB look quite tame. But what I want to say is that the coercion here is particularly palpable because we're not only talking about disruption in the lives of private citizens. State governments themselves depend for their viability as growing concerns on the availability and reliability of electricity. Without it, state government offices would close, prisons would empty, and state police, firefighting, and ambulance services would not be delivered. EPA's argument, by the way, and this is their only argument, only rejoinder to our coercion argument, that no federal funds at stake here misreads and fundamentally trivializes the anti-coercion case law. And I would point out that the court in NFIB described the anti-coercion and anti-commandeering cases as an integrated case law designed to preserve a constitutional federalism architecture. So in our view, coercion arises whenever the federal government is undertaking an action under the spending clause, the commerce clause, or any other enumerated power that threatens states with catastrophic consequences, unless it does what the federal government wishes it to do. So let me close by saying, with all this in mind, EPA produces the most potent brew of federal commandeering and coercion of states in American history. Thank you very much, and I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, David Buchbinder.
Hi, this is David Buchbinder, and I have a somewhat different view of things than David Rivkind. Listening to Mr. Rivkin, you get the impression that truly the sky is falling. I had not heard the list of consequences, including things such as prisons emptying as a result of the Clean Power Plan, but that gives you an idea of the hyperbole that is being thrown around. The Clean Power Plan is different in degree, but not kind, than any other EPA air regulatory program. And it's interesting that EPA's response is basically, yes, if we do these things, states are going to have to, you know, shift their generation. There's going to be a shift from coal to gas and from coal and gas collectively to renewables. But that happens under every rule that we promulgate. And as a matter of fact, the usual parade of horribles comes about every time that EPA promulgates a rule. In the last few years, there's been the cross-state air pollution rule. There have been the regional haze rules. There's the MATS case, the Mercury and Air Toxic Standards case. And again, the same thing. This is going to cause immense problems for the U.S. electrical grid, and the skies will be falling. And, of course, none of that happened, and no one is expecting that to happen here. And it's worth looking at a brief that was written not by David Rivkin, but by Lawrence Tribe on the 10th Amendment and federalism issues. And the very first paragraph of Professor Tribe's brief is worth reciting. It's two sentences. And it begins, 27 states have challenged the rule, the most ever to challenge an EPA rule, representing 80% of the rule's projected emissions reductions. The second sentence is, the 18 states that have filed in support of the rule represent only 12% of the emissions reductions, including two states that the rule does not affect, Vermont and Hawaii. And it's really, really quite interesting that he contrasts the states challenging the rule that have an immense amount of work to do and the states that have supported the rule that have a relatively much smaller amount of work to do. And when you go and this morning I kind of thought it was interesting, and I went and I checked the GDP, the relative GDP of those two sets of states, and it's virtually the same. The states challenging the rule have about 48% of U.S. GDP, and the states supporting the rule have about 45% of U.S. GDP. And the amazing thing is the states supporting the rule have accomplished all of their emissions reductions already, and it hasn't sent them into a tailspin. The power stays on in those states. The U.S. economy has not been wrecked. The prisons are not emptying. The state services are not disappearing. And yet, they have accomplished this already. The idea that other states cannot do this without incredibly dramatic consequences simply is not tenable. So let's turn to the issue of, you know, what does this rule do? And as I said, it does the same thing as every other air rule that EPA has promulgated recently, which is to fall heavily on the coal-fired power sector and to shift generation to gas and to renewables. This does it more explicitly, but the consequence has been identical under all of these rules. And it's very interesting that the costs of this rule, of the Clean Power Plan, are right in the ballpark range for any given one of the rules I have mentioned. For instance, the most recent one and the most controversial was the Mercury and Air Toxic Standards, and that was estimated to cost about $7.4 billion a year in the year 2030. And the Clean Power Plan is going to cost between $5 and $8 billion a year in 2030. In other words, we absorb these sorts of changes and costs all the time without these dramatic impacts. So what happens is the way EPA is considering this is going to result in more changes, perhaps, than we've seen in any individual rule recently, but that it's not anything out of the ordinary, and that ultimately, if states don't want to do anything, EPA can come in and, as a federal agency, promulgate what's called the Federal Implementation Plan, which has given rise to a verb to FIP a state. And the states say, well, that's still no good because we're stuck doing all the work. But the work they would do under a Clean Power Plan FIP is identical to the work that they have had to do when generation has shifted as a result of the mercury and air toxics rule, the cross-state air pollution rule, the regional haze rules, the new ozone rule, etc. There is nothing different about this at all. And the idea that we're all of a sudden playing in a whole new ballpark is just not tenable. The other issue is that there are claims that states are being treated unfairly because EPA is not recognizing that the Clean Air Act and the Clean Air Act regulations give them certain authority. And I think EPA has the better of those arguments. David Rivkin has not touched on them, so I won't go into detail about those, but just leave it with the observation that what EPA is doing is different, maybe in degree, but certainly not in kind from what it's been doing previously, certainly not in cost. And we have the example of states representing half of the GDP in the United States already accomplishing almost all of the required 2030 emissions reductions here in 2016 at no cost to their viability, no cost to their economies, and with no threat that the prisons will be emptying and the ambulances will stop running. So with that, I will turn it back over to Dean as the moderator and let him take it away.
Dean.
Thank you, gentlemen. David, before David Rivkin, I give you a chance to respond, let me open the floor to questions. People can begin to line up to the extent they have questions. So in a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. So now, David Rivkin, you've heard the presentation of David Bookbinder. Why don't you take a minute or two and respond?
Yeah, just thank you, Dean. Just to set the stage, David and I, unfortunately, not on the same page. My point about the catastrophic consequences related entirely to states not being commandeered. Now, there are the economists who project catastrophic consequences from the new energy economy being created. That's not what I'm arguing at all, and frankly, that has no constitutional significance. But again, the EPA has the ability to destroy the existing energy economy. We do not have an ability to create because Congress did not give them the power. So the parade of horribles that is quite real relates to a situation where states refuse to be commandeered. That's why they have no choice but to be commandeered, which is why it's coercive. Point number one. Point number two, more due respect to the passage from Professor Tribe's brief, which you've read, the discussion of which states are supporting what is useful for symbolic purposes. But the Supreme Court's jurisprudence is utterly clear on this issue. The federalism architecture does not belong to the states. And even if all 50 states agreed there was just hunky-dory, but the federal government engaged in commandeering incursion, that is not for them to decide. They cannot rewrite the Constitution. Point number two. Point number three about, you know, this is a trifle, these are matters of degree. First of all, the situation in Prince, and I noticed that, you know, let's try to move away from the Clean Air Arcana and talk about the Constitution here. The burden imposed on states in Prince was truly a trifle. A small role in the compliance with the Brady gun control legislation. That was not good enough for Supreme Court because commandeering is so inherently corrosive of our constitutional architecture. And the final point about incidental effects versus intentional effects and why this is different. EPA could not help itself. It did not say that we wish, as in all the other rules, to accomplish certain air quality results. Of course they're going to have consequences. Whenever you regulate in any particular sphere, it always has consequences. EPA and, frankly, this administration could not help itself. It talked about its desire to do generation shifting and changing in energy economy. And ladies and gentlemen, the changes in energy economy are not an incidental impact of this rule. It is its purpose. This is what this makes this rule different in kind, and not merely a matter of degree. And another thing that's absolutely palpable in this rule is the desire to stake the states with accountability for all of the reliability and affordability consequences that flow therefrom. That is why this is a different animal. That is why it is the most commandeering and coercive rule in all the history of these United States. Thank you.
That was David Rifkin. I want to repeat the call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your question, on your phone. We have one question pending. I want to give David Bookbinder one more shot at this and ask you, David Bookbinder, to address in particular two things. One, can commandeering be waived by states? Or coercion. Does the purpose here matter? Does it matter that if you agree that the express or stated purpose of this regulation is to change the energy infrastructure, to move states from coal to gas to renewables, does that matter?
Well, David Rifkin's completely correct that states cannot agree to waive the federalism issues and the coercion issues, and I wasn't suggesting otherwise. What I was saying was that the states that have already embarked upon this pathway show that, in fact, it is doable without the catastrophic consequences that Mr. Rifkin is talking about, and that it's not that we've got some states for and some states against. Absolutely, that's irrelevant. The point is that a whole bunch of states representing half of the economy in the United States have already accomplished this without any of the catastrophic consequences that Mr. Rifkin and the coal industry keep insisting are going to be the result. And by the way, that is something we hear every time EPA comes out with a rule. Where the litigation over the mercury and air toxics rule is still going on, but my God, it was the constant refrain was, this is going to shut down the American power grid. This is going to mean the lights will be turned off. This will mean there'll be no power for people's homes. As of today, the American power sector is, I believe, 99% in compliance with that rule, and the power has stayed on. These catastrophic things we hear all the time, and frankly, nobody, certainly not the D.C. Circuit, believes it anymore.
Do you have to? This is Dean Reuter again, asking David Bookbinder. Do you have to have catastrophic results, or is it enough if it's provable to say, well, under our compliance as a state, we've had 1% GDP growth. We assert that we would have had 4% GDP growth, but for this. In other words, is the failure to thrive? I mean, do there really have to be catastrophic consequences?
No, but that's an
there
example.
There being coercion or commandeering?
No, not at all. There don't have to be catastrophic consequences. But that is what the argument is premised upon, is that there will be catastrophic consequences.
Forgive me. We should debate the arguments that we put forward. I apologize for interrupting. I repeat for the second time. The catastrophic consequences are going to accrue if the states do not regulate according to the federal instructions. I'm sure David Bookbinder would agree that if states merely sit tight and do nothing after EPA destroys the installed coal-fired capacity's ability to participate in the energy economy, do nothing, it would be catastrophic. Do you agree? If that's, the answer is yes, that's all that matters for purposes of a coercion analysis and purposes of commandeering analysis. I said it now twice.
I don't know why
we don't understand each other.
I don't agree that, with the kind of destroy the energy economy, destroy coal-fired capacity, destroy, et cetera, et cetera. And the changes are going to be extremely mild, as demonstrated by the fact that, half the country is basically already there.
David, forgive me. So you're saying that it's possible for EPA to destroy, in a sense, let's not use big words, to demobilize the coal-fired capacity. It's absolutely clear that's what we're going to do, and it delivers.
I don't think so. I think if you look at EPA's regulatory impact analysis, the share of coal-fired power in the United States in 2030 is a mild, 3 or 4% below where it is today.
That is not true. But okay, let's assume for a second, for purposes of his discussion, I apologize, Dean, that we both, David Burgoyne and I, agree that the purpose of his rule and the intent of his rule is curtail substantially. Let's not use the word destroy, even, because I don't want to throw numbers looking at, because it varies from state to state and region to region. Dramatically curtail the utilization of coal-fired capacity. If that is true, if states do nothing, which is their right under the existing Supreme Court anti-commandeering jurisprudence, if they do nothing, if they do not participate in building the new facilities, would it not be catastrophic?
No, I don't think
so. No, it would not. So they can do nothing. They can just sit tight and do nothing. Okay. I mean, let the record show that that's the disagreement. So EPA would take offline a large chunk of generation, and the states do not need to do anything else. They can afford to do nothing. Okay. It's wrong, but at least now I think the listeners can understand where the difference lies.
Okay. Over to you, Dean.
All right. Again, if you're in the audience, you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, then our lines will be wide open. So let's now turn to the audience.
Hi, this is Gary Wheaton up here in New Hampshire again. A couple questions here, actually two-part question. First, I want to thank Mr. Rifkin for making a legal argument. My question is for Mr. Bookbinder, who made a policy argument. And, you know, I know that people in the environmental world like to use those big catastrophic terms. Mr. Rifkin didn't use those terms, really. So in the end, the question is, you know, where's the end of it? It certainly is catastrophic to the employee of a coal-fired plant. Catastrophic to the maybe hundreds or thousands of employees that are going to lose their jobs. But let's leave the big words behind and say, where's the end? Where does this end? You know, it's might not be catastrophic today, but, you know, how clean does the air get? Zero emissions with zero jobs? You know, who decides where that line is? And my second part of the question is we've cleaned up our air quite a bit over the last 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years. The percentage of global emissions that we produce, basically what is that today compared to the rest of the world? So if we lose 100 jobs or 5,000 jobs to clean the globe's air by 0.008%, you know, is that worth it? And again, where is that line? Where does it end?
This is David Bookbinder. I think that question was directed at me, and I think you're going a little bit beyond the question of the Clean Power Plan. But let's start with the effect of the Clean Power Plan. Right now in the United States, the solar industry employs four times as many people as the coal mining industry. And the coal mining industry has been dying without any sort of impetus from the Clean Power Plan. It's been dying because gas has exploded onto the scene and is incredibly cheap, and everyone's been building gas-fired power plants, and gas has been replacing coal. So as an economic matter, you know, coal has been, you know, is going out of business because of gas, not because of environmental regulations. And if you wish to double check that, you have to take a look at the bankruptcy filings of Arch Coal and Alpha Natural Resources and Peabody Energy, each of which one expressly, flatly stated, we're going into bankruptcy because of gas. So there's that issue. On the larger one as to why the United States is doing these things, that's beyond the issue of the Clean Power Plan, but I'll step back and look at it. The answer is we have a global problem on our hands that has to be solved collectively, and there will be no collective solution to it. There will be no worldwide solution to it unless the United States participates in it, and that is the ultimate reason why the federal government has decided that it has to start regulating the largest source of CO2 emissions in the United States, which are power plants. And the idea, and we'll step back into the policy arena for a moment, the idea that we have a problem of global size and significant consequences where Congress has not acted in the 25 years since that radical environmentalist George Bush, President Bush, the 41st president, since he signed the Rio Treaty in 1992, 24 years ago, Congress has not acted to do anything about climate. And as a result, the Clean Air Act is the only tool available, and the administration will use it, and future administrations will use it unless and until Congress comes up with a better system. And I think ultimately the courts will defer to any reading of the Clean Air Act that allows the agencies to regulate carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases unless and until Congress does something, because otherwise it means that that no one can do anything.
If I may cut in, I'm very tempted to engage in a policy debate, including the proposition that the problem of lack of collective action involves the United States doing something unconditionally and hope that other countries come along. I think if you look at any serious international diplomacy regarding areas, for example, as arms control, I've not exactly noticed that the way things were done, that we've done something unconditionally and then hoped that the Russians or the Chinese or somebody else would join us. But that, frankly, has nothing to do with constitutional law. David perhaps unintentionally made my point. He said that Congress has not done anything regarding climate change. Well, we can agree or disagree whether it's a bad thing, but yes, Congress has not passed legislation authorizing EPA or any other federal agency to really undertake serious regulatory efforts in this area. The problem for David and EPA and others who espouse this view is under our constitutional scheme, the lack of delegation, statutory delegation from Article 1 to Article 2, doesn't mean you get to rewrite the existing statutes. It means you cannot do diddly, ladies and gentlemen. That is why this CPP, Clean Power Plan, is so damn unconstitutional. If Congress gave EPA the ability to regulate in addition to air quality, to supplant states when it comes to preempt states, be technical, when it comes to generation and distribution of electricity, it would be a different story. We can talk about job losses. We can talk about costs. It would be debate of economists. But Congress did not do this. The problem, again, I'm probably saying it for the fourth time in the last 25 or 30 minutes, the problem is we have incomplete preemption. EPA is creating results on the ground by taking down a large portion of existing energy economy. And I don't want to throw numbers at you, but I can tell you that EPA's own rhetoric attests to this. The White House own rhetoric attests to it. They use words like generation shifting. Okay, not talking about a small decline in the utilization. That creates a situation where the states, I'm repeating myself again, have no choice but to step in and regulate using their police power. That is a classical problem that Supreme Court, in a series of cases that span at least three decades, has declared to be unconstitutional. That's all that matters here. And again, it is far more onerous for the states to be commandeered in this area, back to my example about Prince, or even New York. Small exertions of federal authority to push states to do small things, okay? Low-level radioactive nuclear waste in New York, Brady gun control legislation in Prince. And the Supreme Court said, no, 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 it is per se unconstitutional. We have lots more commandeering and coercion here. That's how our constitutional system works.
This is David Bookbinder. I don't understand how that is any different when under any other EPA rule, the cross-state rule or the mercury rule or the haze rule or the ozone rule, coal-fired power plants have closed down as a result of those rules. And the state has asked to go out and said, okay, we need to replace this generation capacity.
Okay, I'm going to repeat my point about intentional versus incidental impacts. It is absolutely true that in a modern administrative state, there's connectivity among different regulatory spheres. It is absolutely true that every time EPA or any other federal agency regulates in a major way, it has spillover effects. But EPA, unfortunately, fundamentally condemns itself out of its own mouth the same way, frankly, the other example is the immigration executive order, where the administration also condemned itself out of its own mouth by trumpeting how revolutionary and unprecedented it was. The administration's goal is to change the energy economy. It is not a consequence of specific reductions imposed in carbon emissions imposed on power plants. It is its goal. That is the most consequential thing. And second, in terms of the scope of impact on coal-fired power plants, it far transcends everything that's been done to now. Again, don't take my word for it. That's what the administration has said. So both in kind and degree, this is different. And by the way, if this is not unconstitutional, then the entire Supreme Court jurisprudence having to do with coercion and commandeering goes out the window. Okay? I mean, seriously, David, what is the difference between a situation in Prince and New York that had a minor imposition on state regulatory dignitas in terms of forcing them to do the bidding and the one here? You're telling me that the states have to do less here than they had to do in Prince?
No,
really?
I'm saying that, as EPA has pointed out, its regulatory power is exercised directly over the generation facilities and not over the state.
But that is shilly-shelling, because if EPA's regulatory power was exercised, for example, on toy makers, that would be a different story. It was exercised on a purely private industry that is able to rejigger itself entirely on its own without involvement of state police powers, it would be different. Unfortunately for EPA, it didn't just go after existing coal-fired plants. EPA knows full well, and any casual reader of a rule would know full well, that what EPA expects is that once the coal-fired generating assets go down, they would have to be replaced. Guess what, David? They cannot be replaced by private parties acting their own, because that's in the sweet spot, as I said a couple of times, of state police power. That's where the commandeering comes from, where the coercion comes from. What am I missing?
The same thing, as I said, you're missing that under every other rule, the coal-fired units close down and and other units close down, and the state has to then, go through its processes of when private parties apply to them and say, we need to rebuild capacity and, build another plant here or do something else here, the state goes through the exact same things it's being asked to do under this.
The other rules, the closure of existing power plants and their rebuilding was an incidental consequence, and a predictable consequence, but incidental consequence of air quality regulation. I repeat for the fifth time. EPA said.
Yeah, I feel like we're going around in a loop here.
Okay.
We do have a couple more audience questions. Sorry to interrupt. We'll get to the audience questions in 1 second, but let me ask just a straight question to David Bookbinder. Is there agreement that the stated purpose of the rule is to change the energy economy, that's the stated purpose of the rule? And if so, does that matter in your analysis?
It's certainly not the stated purpose in the actual rulemaking itself. It's certainly the stated purpose that EPA and other administration officials have used publicly, but it's not the one that's actually used in the rule. Whether or not that makes a difference, I don't know. But they're absolutely clear that that is the language used elsewhere, but it is not the language used in the rule.
Okay, and so even if it were used in the rule, you're not clear how that works in your analysis. It's not definitive in the way it seems to be for David Rifkin.
I don't think it makes, in my view, I don't think it makes any difference. I think the court is going to look at the actual practical consequences, regardless of here we're regulating for mercury. or we're regulating for mercury and power plants close over here, we're regulating for carbon dioxide over here, and the carbon dioxide ones, those are illegitimate because it's going to result in more renewable power or more gas-fired power as opposed to the regulatory stuff on the on mercury or ozone or anything else.
Right.
Is
the mercury rule also being challenged?
Oh, yes.
Right.
Not on constitutional grounds, but anyway.
Yeah, but not right. Not on constitutional grounds.
Is there a mechanism to challenge the cumulative effect of several different regulations as on constitutional grounds as coercive or commandeering?
You asking me?
I'm asking either one of you, or do you have to take it one regulation at a time, or can you say it's the sum total of these five regulations that EPA and Department of Interior have passed that amount to coercion on a state?
There has not been a case that combined, aggregated different rules. I suppose if it came as a part of a same rulemaking package, you would not be, it would be a more difficult question if you have to combine rules proposed by different departments and agencies. But we don't need to worry about it here.
Right.
Again, it's the combination of intent. And, by the way, let me just say it may be useful for viewers very briefly or listeners to appreciate. Look, if you take down a few coal-fired plants or any other plants, it is not sufficiently coercive or commandeering, because it really doesn't require the states to fundamentally rejigger their overall planning, their overall approach to how to maintain energy economy. But quantity has its own quality. If you do it enough, if you destroy enough, then the rebuilding task inescapably falls on the shoulders of the states, and that's what causes coercion and commandeering. So aside from the articulation of the purpose, which is very useful, it is the scope, the magnitude of a change here.
All right. Let's go back to the audience now. We've got two questions pending. Go right ahead, caller.
It seems we have a little bit of time here to discuss the science behind this, and it seems to me that there's a tremendous amount of every scientist that's paid for by the government and the global warming fans says that science is settled, but it's not. The science says that, or observation shows that the Earth's temperature is the sun's temperature in Kelvin divided by 21, and when the sun gets hotter, the Earth gets hotter. The tree ring data can verify that, and the ice ring data verifies that. And Gore's two graphs were not placed on the same graph because the CO2 lags the increase in temperature. The temperature rises, there are more plants, and then more CO2 happens. It's not that temperature is caused by CO2. And even if it were, the CO2 is constantly being reduced right now by the falling cost of solar generation. And it's going to happen whether or not coal plants are shut down by fiat order with a possible damaging effects to the economy. I mean, our economy is not doing all that well. Part of that is a tax policy that is an internal tariff. We have income taxes and everything else that increases our tariffs above the tariffs we charge other people to bring goods into the country, other countries to bring goods in. But this kind of disruption of our energy increases the cost of energy, thereby increases the cost of manufacturing, and it is a disaster. So that's not really a question, but you may want to comment on the science aspects of this thing.
I'll defer to David Bookbinder. I would say that the science, don't disagree with your point, but the science really has no constitutional significance here. Let me just say this. Even if doing what EPA is doing was absolutely magnificently beneficial, and no doubt exists about it, the right way to do it in our constitutional system is to have what it's known as complete preemption. Have Article 1 give EPA or FERC or some combination of both ability to preempt states entirely in the sphere. Then come to the states, like in Hodel, and say, you have a regulatory instructions, or we take it over 100%, we'll bear all the costs and all the accountability that comes with it. That's not what happened here. So it is not a question of how stupid it is or how wonderful it is. It's how you do it. The Constitution is fundamentally about how you do things. There are very few things that cannot be done inherently, and this is certainly not one of them.
David Bookbinder, comment.
Oh, I was just going to say on the interplay between the science and the law, EPA did what was called the endangerment finding a few years back, and it was challenged in the courts, and it was upheld by the D.C. Circuit, and it was, along with the substantive legal questions presented in the regulatory case, the Supreme Court was asked to take it. And the Supreme Court took the substantive regulatory issues in a case called UARG, but didn't even bother taking the appeal on the grounds of, you know, that the science is not justified. Not even the four justices who in the Massachusetts case said there's no such thing as global warming, not even the four justices who said we're going to look at the regulatory consequences of this climate regulation bothered to, you know, take up the issue of whether the science was justified. So, I mean, as a legal matter, it is no longer in play.
I believe we have time for a final question. Let's check in with one more caller now.
Yeah, well, now that we've settled the science, maybe it's time to talk about the math. Every mathematician and scientist who's looked at the Clean Power Plan has decided that it's not going to have anything but a tenth of an inch or more of effect on rising levels of sea levels, and only a couple of tenths of an inch of a degree in temperature difference, even if it's enacted. I mean, isn't this all about style, about doing something, even if it has no practical effect, rather than doing something that might actually be effective?
Let me try to go first. I don't disagree with you, and as I said, if we had a different phone call, we can have a very wonky discussion about the not the science, really talking about the impact of various regulatory measures. Israel, let me say this. The reason those regulatory measures are so utterly minuscule in their impact is not only because it's a global problem, but because even comes to the United States, and this is, by the way, buttresses the notion that Article 2 does not have the tools given to it by Article 1, is because they don't work well. They don't work well because those tools are not real, okay? But let me again say, as far as the constitutional dimension of this issue is concerned, it makes absolutely no difference. I mean, the Constitution is the most compelling instrument that drives and structures and cabins ultimately all aspects of governmental policy. So even if David Buchbinder can convince us all that a failure to do CPP would produce a catastrophe, it would make absolutely no difference. The way to solve it is to do it the right way constitutionally, and this is not
I think Mr. Buchbinder has been very open in saying, no, that the Constitution doesn't matter. Congress doesn't matter. What matters here is the EPA and the courts are going to force this through unless Congress does something. So, I mean, he's not really debating with you that the Constitution doesn't permit this. He's saying, we don't care. Constitution doesn't matter. This is too important a problem to let the Constitution and Congress and the people get in the way. The EPA and the courts are going to decide it. Is that a fair restatement of what you said?
No, I don't think so. I am saying that the Constitution, that the actions EPA are taking do not offend principles of federalism, and they do not offend the Tenth Amendment. And I'm saying that against that background, you know, you're going to have this plan is going to be in the courts, and the courts will say, we believe that there's a problem. And the administration believes there's a problem, and the overwhelming scientific evidence is that there's a problem, and there is no other mechanism that has been put forth except this. And with that in the back of their minds, they're going to say, you know, there's not only is there no constitutional problem with this, we don't see any problems with the Clean Air Act itself with it. I think that's an important consideration. I think that's going to be the issue in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will simply come down on it in, you know, in that direction. I don't think there's constitutional infirmity. I think the real issues are with the Clean Air Act, and I think ultimately that's where the judges will look at the real-world situation and say, well, this is the only tool that is available, and we're going to read it in such a way that it can be used as opposed to not used. But I don't think the constitutional issues
David, I'm being a little unfair, perhaps, but let me say this. In some ways, you are unintentionally perhaps making my case. The fact that it's the only tool available, Section 111D, has nothing to do with whether or not it is an appropriate tool. Whether or not it's an appropriate tool has to depend, if you take seriously the Supreme Court's anti-commandeering, anti-coercion jurisprudence, is can EPA do what needs to be done on its own, therefore having a fully viable preemptive threat, and then given a state a choice to regulate according to EPA instructions or be supplanted? That's the only question. The fact that there are no other tools is a classical policy argument. It has nothing to do with a constitutional argument, because it is entirely plausible that there are no tools to do this.
David, I agree it doesn't have anything to do with the constitutional argument. I'm saying insofar as the Clean Air Act arguments are concerned, the constitutional argument, I think, is infirm, not because of policy issues, but simply because this is, as you and I have gone over this several times, this is really different perhaps in quantity, but not in quality as to any other rule that EPA has promulgated.
Can you humor me and tell me this? You and I disagree, and we are not going to resolve it today, as to how dramatic of an impact this is going to have on coal-fired generation, and therefore we disagree about how many things states would have to do. But if you can humor me, and let's say that this rule kills coal-fired generation. I know you disagree, but let's say it does. And to offset that, states have to do many, 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 many regulatory things instead of just sitting back and letting private parties construct the energy economy. Would you find that objectionable in light of existing jurisprudence, or do you think it's just fine?
No, I don't find that objectionable at all, because it's
okay. So then
different in quantity, not quality.
And there's no cabining principle here, which, by the way, is fatal to pretty much any serious separation of powers case, which was very much in play in FIB versus Sebelius. So it's okay, perhaps, for the federal government to put state to a little bit of an effort, but there's no upper limit to that. So if you were told, again, I'm making this up a little bit, but I'm trying to dramatize the difference here, that 80% of the time of a state utility commissions and 40% of the time of state legislatures in the next few years will be devoted to complying, to taking actions that would make CPP work, that would not bother you at all?
Yes, that would bother me. I find those numbers to be, you know, so fanciful and exactly along the lines of every exaggerated threat that we've heard from the power industry for 30 years.
David, I'm not talking about that at all. I'm talking about what states would have to do. I'm not talking about cost of private sector. I don't represent private sector. Okay?
The ultimate
I'm talking about states as sovereigns. Okay, so how much is enough? Is 20% of a time of PUCs enough?
That's an excellent question, but there is certainly no question in my mind that this is akin to every other rule. And so what you're saying is that all of these rules are constitutionally infirm because every one of them requires the state to do something when private parties, as a result of the rule, shift their generation. I don't see that this rises to the quantity being so great as to shift it into something that into a new paradigm.
And do you remember how little? Sorry, David. Sorry, Dean. Forgive me.
Well, David, finish your thought, and then I'm afraid we're going to have to adjourn, David.
No, I was going to say, if you look at the Prince case, the degree of burden put on state police forces doing Brady's checks was tiny. Tiny. Okay? And it was not good enough.
We're going to have to leave it there. It's a question that you guys have done a great job of outlining your particular positions. I certainly appreciate it. Thank you both for your time today. This discussion to be continued. We have an event tomorrow at the Press Club. If you're local, you could attend that at lunchtime. But the case being argued in part by David Rifkin on September 27th. Thank you, gentlemen. To the audience, thank you as well. A reminder to check our schedule for upcoming telephone conference calls. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast.
For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.